Ken Stone from KTCA's Newsnight Minnesota.
And I'm Martin Costi, Capitol reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. We're your hosts for tonight's program.
For the rest of the hour, citizens from around the state will join us as we talk with Minnesota's legislative leadership. It is the latest collaboration in the Citizens Forum Project, a public journalism collaboration between KTCA, Channel 2, the Star Tribune newspaper, and Minnesota Public Radio. For the past couple of hours, citizens have been meeting in Minneapolis, Bemidji, and Mankato. They've been hearing from one of our guests tonight, Finance Commissioner Pam Wheelock. They've also been talking among themselves by video phone, technology you'll be seeing throughout tonight's show. Lori Sturdivant with the Star Tribune is with the citizens in the paper's downtown newsroom. Newsnight's Greater Minnesota reporter Jim Newman is with citizens at the Bemidji Middle School. And Karen Louise Booth from Minnesota Public Radio is with citizens at the Mankato Public Library. They are all gathered to talk with tonight's studio guest. We'd like to welcome Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe, Speaker of the House Steve Swigum, and Ventura Administration Finance Commissioner Pam Wheelock. Let's get right to it. We'll go to the Star Tribune in Minneapolis.
Well, hi, everybody. We have nine citizens here from around the metro area who have been discussing the budget deal that was arrived at on Tuesday and discussing some of the issues that still remain. I asked for a show of hands. I asked how many people are satisfied with this budget deal, how many are unsatisfied, and how many just don't know yet. Of our group of nine, four said they were pretty satisfied with what's happened so far. Nobody was unsatisfied yet, but five aren't sure what to think yet. So tonight, maybe you have some persuading to do, legislators. Our first question comes from Duane Ringhand from Anoka. Duane, come on up.
Thank you very much. My question, after I express my disappointment in the cut for the top bracket, is directed to Roger. What was the reason that the Senate finally went along with the cut in the top bracket?
Well, I guess part of it was because come Sunday afternoon, Governor Ventura decided that he was going to go along with that 0.5 reduction at the top rate and go along with the House. He made that decision. Not, of course, until I'd had a chance to talk with him and tried to convince him otherwise. We realized that there was going to be a reduction at the top rate, but I felt that until you made that decision, we should see what other sorts of things could be a part of that overall package. And in the final results, it ended up being negotiated out between the Speaker and myself that we would end up with an additional $100 million for K-12 education, basically to get the Senate number for K-12 education. And like any package you put together, there are some things that you like, some things that you might not like, but overall it's a decent package.
Speaker Swigum, why did the Republicans in the House hold out so strongly for the cut to that top income tax bracket rate?
Fairness. It seems pretty fair that if you're going to cut taxes, which we certainly need to do in Minnesota, that it should be done across the board, including everybody, and it's kind of a fairness type thing. Obviously, Minnesota's tax system is very, very progressive, and I don't think we wanted to make it more progressive. So it was bottom line fairness.
I'm actually curious about Commissioner Wheelock. What exactly changed the governor's mind? He'd pretty much been backing the Senate's position on this top rate throughout the session, at least saying, show me the numbers. I think Sunday took a lot of people by surprise, and it really made it harder for the Senate to stick to that position any longer. What happened there?
I think from the governor's perspective, there had been discussions for about a week and a half, and it was clear after about 5 hours of discussions with legislative leadership on Saturday that there really was an impasse between these last issues of the top rate, and significant movement had not been made. And with the deadline approaching, May 17th fast approaching, the governor really felt it was an important role for him to play to try to break that impasse and get some movement on the last unresolved issues with the legislative leadership.
All right, let's go to Bemidji and hear from a citizen there.
Hello, Ken. I'm Jim Newman at Bemidji Middle School with eight citizens from north central Minnesota. And their quick and easy response to the poll was they basically support the budget compromise that was crafted over the last few days. 7 supporting it, and just 1 person saying she was uncertain. People here particularly favor the use of the tobacco endowment money from the tobacco settlement going to health endowments rather than right back to the taxpayers. As always, though, the devil is in the details, and they're a little bit worried about what might happen over the next few days in those ever-so-secretive conference committees. I have a citizen here with a question, Beverly Kaler, who's going to talk about fairness, what she considers a problem about the fundamental fairness between the metro area and rural Minnesota.
Senator Leader Moll, House Speaker Squigham, as leaders of the state government of all of Minnesota, what are you doing to assure equal distribution of funds between the metro and the outlying areas? As citizens of northern Minnesota, we are concerned that we often get shortchanged.
Senator, I'll let you take that first.
Well, first let me begin by saying conference committees are open to the public, and so I want people in Bemidji to know that when the conferees make their decisions on the overall budget bills, they do that before the public. These are open meetings and you can attend. As it relates to the overall distribution of the state's resources, if I'm not mistaken, northern Minnesota, if you take a look at all of the counties in northern Minnesota and you take a look at income and sales taxes paid to the general fund or to the state treasury, and then look at the resources that are returned back to those counties, all of those counties get more back than what they send to the state capital. And I think that's the case in, I think, about 85 out of the 87 counties, if I'm not mistaken. And the reason how that works is because under the school aid formulas and highway gas tax distribution and aid for senior citizens through Medicare, Medicaid formulas, all of that works out basically to greater Minnesota's advantage based upon the taxes that they paid to the state treasury. That's not going to change under the agreements that we worked out this session.
That is an interesting question. There is at least the perception that greater Minnesota gets shortchanged by the metro area. You hear it on a lot of different issues, whether it's transportation or what have you. Representative?
Well, we also hear the other, Ken. We also hear that the metro area gets shortchanged for the dollars that go out to rural Minnesota. I think it depends upon where you're sitting and who you're listening to.
But, what do you do about that perception, though, that one side's getting shortchanged versus the other?
Well, first of all, Roger is very correct about the number. It's about, I thought it was like 4 counties that actually were net, quote, net losers, but whether it be 2, 3, or 4, you know, I think we got to look at the situation as being Minnesotans and not necessarily, you know, whether you're winning and losing. We try to make formulas that are somewhat reflective of need, somewhat reflective of the wealth of a certain area or not, and that's why we have the LGA formulas, the distribution way we do, the education formulas, the distribution the way we do to recognize need, to recognize property wealth of certain areas. And you know, and the bottom line, fairness always ends up being in the eyes of the beholder, where you happen to be sitting at that time.
But Mr. Speaker, it does occur to me, though, that regardless of whether or not we see the state as a whole, I think your caucus in the House came in trying to correct some, I think, perceived imbalances, especially on school funding. Isn't that correct? I mean, where did you see the imbalance when you came in?
There is no doubt that in the House bill that passed in education, we had felt that over the past years that probably many outstate, more outstate rural school districts had been shortchanged in the formula. So we provided an equity piece in the education bill that passed out of the House, meaning that most of the rural Minnesota schools, the outstate schools, would be net winners. I you know, if you got to pick winners and losers, but you know, we try to tweak the formulas a little bit, and that perception is there, and that's why the House bill probably treated outstate as school districts, potentially a little bit better than metro school districts, which would have been seen to be treated by the bill.
Although some suburban metro school districts did better too, I think, right?
Depending upon how they came forward in either the equity or the referendum equity, the dollars that we were equalizing there.
Well, I'm curious. Can somebody tell me who the quote losers were among the counties that?
Well, I think it's Hennepin.
Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted are the three that I've always heard are the ones where
more tax revenues come out of and go back to.
Right. And they're losing even more, perhaps, this year than previous years, or not?
No, I don't think so. That's the case. Yeah. I think, one of the big things, of course, we're in a big debate over transportation issues. The Highway Transportation Fund, for instance, that was, I think, put together back in the 50s. Well, all you have to do is look at the demographic shifts since the 50s, and you can see the changes. So that obviously has a weighting towards greater Minnesota, if you would. But when you add them all up, by and large, it's there are winners and losers if you go by the revenues coming in. But I think the speaker is right. We have to look at the state as a whole. Different regions have different unique situations, sometimes problems that they have to overcome, and we try to recognize those in a myriad of formulas for these various programs.
I'd like to go to Mankato in a moment, but very quickly, Commissioner, occasionally one of the criticisms that you've heard against the administration is not enough concern about greater Minnesota, the governor is ignoring us, that kind of thing. How worried were you about when you put together the budget, about addressing that perception?
A couple of observations about his proposed budget. First of all, I think he did recommend spending in areas that are important to outstate Minnesota, particularly focusing on education, K-12 spending, and an emphasis on that formula to make sure that our school districts have adequate resources to teach our kids. There were not dramatic changes in state policy. Clearly, I think the governor has some concerns about our property tax system, thinks that it's complicated, thinks that it's been changed in ways that don't leave us with an understandable, rational system. And he certainly wants to look at things like that over the next couple of years, but I think that he has exercised some prudence and restraint in saying that I want to understand the significance and the trade-offs of these changes before I just throw them out on the table and ask legislators to vote on them. So there are certain areas that I think need to be looked at about whether they make sense or not, but I think that he certainly understands that just because you have scattered farms in the outstate area, you still need a road to link them, even though you don't have as many people living on them as you might in a metro area. So those are important investments in the state.
Okay, let's head on down to the Mankato Library.
Hello, Ken. This is Karen Louise Booth, and I'm in Mankato with 9 citizens from the region. And just as the last election saw a good participation of voters, you can be certain that there is an engaged public in greater Minnesota paying very close attention to what's happening this legislative session, particularly in recent days. But if a week is a long time in the life of a campaign, the remaining days of this session, anything could happen. Our first person here to ask a question is Richard Owney, who is Associate Director at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter. Richard?
I do need to do some adjusting on the camera. Senator Moe and Mr. Speaker, I was pleased to hear you talk about the K-12 funding bill, and I have a specific concern about how you might spend the increased funding towards specifically decreasing class size as opposed to perhaps giving it to the general formula. And my friend Gary from Lake Crystal, who is involved in farming, has some specific concerns about using the increased funding to address rural Minnesota school building and infrastructure needs, especially in light of the possible decrease in rural property taxes and the effect that might have on school funding. And I thank you for a response.
Well, Richard, first of all, I think I heard you said you were from Gustavus Adolphus College. My son is going to be going to school there next year, so I hope you take good care of him down there in St. Peter. I give him a good education. We're certainly looking towards equity in funding, bringing dollars to local districts in the area of the formula. Each caucus had provisions in their bill addressing lower class size, led by the governor. And let me give the governor great kudos for doing that. I think the governor made that a campaign issue during the last campaign. The Senate caucus as well as the House caucus had money in our education bills aimed at reducing class size. But the major focus, I think, certainly in the House caucus, I know of the governor, was to get money on the formula, a formula that had not been increased to keep pace with inflation over the past years, more money in the formula than I think has probably been sent out in the last decade, and that's been our focus, and that continues to be our focus as Senator Moe and I and Commissioner Wheelock negotiated over the past 3 or 4 days, and we talked about the additional money going to education. All of us agreed that the money should go on the formula to help universally all students in all districts in the state, rather than the state, you know, kind of picking one area or one district or winners and losers.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that is the speaker's correct. I think it's a record K-12 funding bill. There will be significant increases in the formula, but I believe, at least I hope, what will come out of the conference committee are a couple of other factors. There will be resources set aside for school districts to make some decisions on what might be local problems. If in fact their class size is an issue, they will have resources to address that. If they want to look at all-day kindergarten, they may be able to choose that option, or to use some of the revenues that the general fund now are used to subsidize special education. We also have a factor, at least in the Senate bill, that I hope comes out of the conference committee report, is designed to start to cushion the impact for the declining enrollment districts. There are 150 districts now in the state that are experiencing enrollment decline. I think we have to start putting in a factor in place, because it won't be long before most all districts in the state will be experiencing enrollment decline. But I'm confident that school districts will look at the agreement that hopefully we'll come to within the next 24, 48 hours as being a very good K-12 funding bill.
Senator, is there a chance that the agreement about how to spend the money on education, could that somehow be derailed by the disagreement over the profile of learning?
I hope not. I certainly hope that those are, you know, we've treated them as separate issues, because there are two different conference committees. I know
but one of the arguments is we're not going to throw money at education unless we have a good plan.
Well, I think the argument that I think it goes, we should not put more money into education if we don't have the kind of standards and accountabilities. And certainly we're working towards resolution of that, and maybe that's a question you can pose to the administration, because they did suggest an option for the conference committee on the profiles as to how we might work our way out of that.
Commissioner?
Thank you, Senator, for putting me up. I think it's fair to say that the governor is disappointed that the House and the Senate has been unable to reach an agreement on this, and that he feels very strongly that we really need to keep profiles in place. There are some modifications to it that probably should be made, and I think that he has indicated a willingness to have his administration play a larger role in resolving this by saying, let's agree to resolve it this session by not specifically putting all these changes in legislation, but give us increased flexibility through a rulemaking process in order to make those necessary changes. And it's certainly hopeful that that will be enough to allow both the House and the Senate to reach some agreement and have that move forward.
This is, I guess, a question more for the speaker, but also for the rest of you. In the sort of more larger political picture here, is there some point in which you put too much money into education? I think we've all seen the polls where Minnesotans' top two priorities right now in state politics are reduce taxes, increase funding for education. And so I think we have the session that came out of some of those opinions. We have, you know, record tax cuts, record education increases. We're nearly $8 billion over 2 years now for K-12 in the states. Is there a point at which, you know, there's too much of a good thing? I mean, it almost seems as though this is being poll-driven or not. Maybe I'm being too cynical about it.
Well, you certainly want accountability, Martin. But as I've traveled the state from Mankato to Minneapolis to Bemidji, people have told me one thing, if I've been listening correctly, or three things, if I've been listening correctly. They have said, cut our taxes, fund our schools, work in a bipartisan way towards not conflict, but cooperation. Maybe we should say a tripartisan way right now. And that's what has happened. Now, not everybody, as Senator Moe said, is going to agree with every part of a package. But we have a package together that can be supported by Democrats, by Reform Party governor, by Republicans, doing the three things that I hear more folks of the state saying than anything else. And
so if nothing happens to the profile, if no agreement can come about on the profile and the profile remains as is, will the House still support the education spending?
Yes. Yes, without question, and I think appropriately so. Martin asked the question of, is it too much of a good thing? Martin, over the past years, I would think that you have said, you could say that at least on the formula, we have not put enough money into education to keep pace with inflation over the past 10 years. Now, there's been money in education. You know, it's gone in debt service, or it's gone to one district or another in the form of a grant, or it's gone in a concentration aid, you know, different categories. But on the formula, Martin, it has not kept pace with inflation, and that's what is being done this year.
Okay, let's get to some more citizens.
I would just add one point, and that is that because of the unique state and local partnership on funding of K-12 education, if the state allows for more resources, that does relieve the pressure on the local school districts to levy more on the property taxes.
In other words, indirect property tax relief.
Right. All right, let's go to some more citizens, and let's head back over to the Star Tribune in Minneapolis.
Well, we'd like to turn the conversation back to taxes, if we could. I must tell you, my group of nine citizens have a good deal of ambivalence and uncertainty about the tax deal that you've cut, and maybe it would be good to explain it just a bit more. But five of our nine citizens here said they were disappointed to see a rate cut in the top bracket. Marion Rucker from Minneapolis is here with me. She's got a question about the rebate portion of the tax agreement. Marion?
Good evening. My question is two-part. First part deals with the elderly and disabled on fixed incomes, and I would like to find out, will they receive a tax rebate, and if so, how much? And I also would like to find out, what formula did you use to come up with the figures for each tax bracket?
Okay, we're going to give this to the commissioner, and the other question is, Commissioner, when are those checks going to go out?
This is the benefit of having a staff person here for these questions. The rebate is one of the reasons why the governor felt so strongly about delivering the 1999 rebate in the form of a sales tax, is because it does hit a broader population, including the elderly, that may not have an income tax liability, but certainly have paid sales tax, property tax, have other tax burdens. So we're very pleased that there seems to be an agreement with leadership, or that there is an agreement with leadership, to deliver that rebate in the form of a sales tax. The average per household will be around $660 per household, and it's based on your income and assumptions about your sales tax burden based on your income. So there's a schedule in place, and that's how it is calculated, but the average is about $660. The sales tax rebate will come out around the middle of August, and there will be checks mailed to individuals' homes. So if you filed your income taxes last year and you filed for some kind of property tax rebate, you'll be eligible for a check this year.
All right, let's go to another citizen question, and we'll go to Bemidji for that one.
Thank you, Ken. I'm here with Jim Millis, who is a small business owner from Grand Rapids. He has a question about an issue that was receiving quite a lot of attention during Jesse Ventura's gubernatorial campaign. Jim?
Hi. Gentlemen, one of the governor's planks in his election, a strong plank, was reduction in sales and license plate fees. And based on what I read in the papers, that really hasn't been settled yet. And to give an example, I recently got a family vehicle from Michigan, a four-year-old vehicle. Paid $30 a year, my father did in Michigan, for license plates. When I came to Minnesota with that vehicle and registered it, I paid $233 for the same plates. Now, this is a small sport utility. I'm a small business owner, and I have a cargo van that is on the road nearly every week. That vehicle can haul up to 6,000 pounds, and I pay $75 a year for license tabs on that. I don't quite understand what the logic is for these license plate fees. And I wonder if there is any logic.
Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, first of all, I'll start. The license tab fees go into the transportation fund, just like the gas tax. And I know people don't like it, but I suspect one of the rationale of paying higher license tabs fees is that we've not had a gas tax increase since 1986. That's one rationale. I realize people can make a strong argument that because of the depreciation of a vehicle in the first couple of years, we should be bringing that down a little quicker than we do. The Senate bill, in the Senate tax bill, we do have some reduction in the motor vehicle license tab fees. I believe the conferees today actually upped that a little bit. They want to get about a little over 20% reduction. Keep in mind, we have a certain amount that we've set aside for tax relief, and the biggest chunk of that is going to go for income tax relief, and then what's left over, we'll have to fit in property tax relief, license tabs reductions, discussions about the provider tax and other taxes as well. So I suspect that there will be, well, I'm hopeful there will be some reduction, but it's not going to be to the level that the governor suggested in his budget.
The agreement that we've come upon has basically decided two things in the area of the tax conference committee. One is the amount of money that's available for the tax cut in this biennium and next biennium. That being $1.6 billion available for some type of tax reductions in the next biennium. The second thing is that at a minimum, the tax rate cuts will be a half, that's percent across the board. And we're hoping that the conference committee will come out with a little higher percentage or a little bit more of a bracket expansion in the middle income taxpayer, very similar to a bill that passed out of the House about a month ago. Now, having said that, that leaves some other monies available and everything is in the mix. But in the mix, I need to tell you, there's going to be some property tax reform or relief in there. I don't think either the House or the Senate or the governor wants homestead properties, property taxes on homes to go up, certainly not farms. We're going to have some type of a farm property tax reform or relief piece in there. We have the sick tax, the provider tax to look at, which I think is a very erroneous tax. The marriage penalty needs to be looked at. And in the mix is the question of whether we're able to afford at this point a time the reduction in the car license tabs or not.
If I could just add, I think with the agreement that we reached as part of the exercise to set conference for target committees, the half-half-half by itself is only about a third of the tax portion that's available for tax relief. Now, certainly we want to add middle-income relief. We want to talk about bracket expansion. We talk about other changes. But that's about roughly two-thirds. So there's roughly $500 million. There's roughly $500 million available still to do, $400 to $500 million to do relief. And there are going to have to be some tough decisions that are made. But from the governor's perspective, there is no clear rationale. There's no relationship between the rate structure and the use of the road. It's a way to deliver significant tax relief that all Minnesotans that go to on an annual basis or once or twice a year, depending on how many vehicles they have, it's a way to deliver significant relief and make us more competitive with the surrounding states. And he thinks that after income tax, that should be the second highest priority for tax relief in that package.
Well, Commissioner, listening to some of the rhetoric in that tax conference committee over the past couple of days, you get the sense that the whole argument now is being framed as, and I don't know if this is a valid situation, but it certainly sounds like it's sick tax or the so-called Minnesota Care provider tax versus the car tab fees. That's going to be maybe one or the other. Is that a fair, at least that's the way they go back and forth, because it sounds like they're debating which reduction, which tax would be more favorable to, you know, the middle class. And is that the way this is going to end up being decided, between those two things?
Martin, between those two things, and I guess I'd like to add a third, and that would be property tax. You know, both the House and Senate bills had some property tax reform, quote, relief in their bills, both aimed at homeowners, commercial, industrial, rental property, and certainly a very substantial farm piece in both of the House and Senate bills.
So what decides?
So it's three things rather than the two things.
Well, what decides it between, say, those three things? And is it are we looking out for a certain group of income, certain income groups in our state? Are we looking out for what the state can pay for over the long term? Well, what do you think is finally going to be the deciding factor there?
I'm not sure.
Your politics?
Well, it's. I think the speaker and the commissioner framed it. There's so much on the table. Right now, two-thirds of it is off the table in the form of the income tax reduction. And I think the speaker and I at least agree the property tax is the next most important, regardless of, I realize the governor thinks the license tabs, and my guess it could very well be a portion of each. I don't know, but you certainly cannot do all of them. I know that.
Just a brief response. I think the governor is certainly supportive of a property tax relief plan, but we've provided significant relief to property tax in the last couple of years, and I think what he would like to do is, before we pump more money into providing relief to a structure that really doesn't make any sense anymore, we should fix that first and then talk about providing relief as part of fixing that system. The provider tax, I think we're looking at that and think that it would be hard for them, with the priority on income tax, to make significant change in that program without causing problems down the road.
Okay, let's hear from another citizen, and we'll go to Mankato for that one.
Thank you, Ken. One group of people that we haven't discussed yet this evening are those living on fixed incomes, many of whom are senior citizens. I'm here with Shirley Torgerson, who has a question to that effect. Shirley?
Yes, I'm concerned when I hear that the people on Social Security who don't file income tax are not going to be able to get any of the money from the sales tax rebate. I would like to hear more about that, please.
I should file an amended form.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, please.
Well, also, I think they will be. I think we're also looking, Shirley, at using property tax refund forms to access names or property tax refunds. The property tax rebates, which have been given in the past years, would be used as names, and then there would be a minimum, I think, too, isn't there, Commissioner Wheelock?
Yeah, I think the short answer is, if you didn't have a tax liability last year and so you didn't file a return, you should file one now. File an amended 1998 return so that you're still eligible then. We'll use the records from last year, and so it's not too late if you have not filed just because you didn't have an income tax liability.
Isn't there some sort of a deadline that they might have missed, April 15th?
I believe that either has been changed or certainly can be changed so that we can extend it at least through the end of some agreed upon period, but so we can still get out the checks.
All right, very good. Why don't we take another citizen's question? Lori Sturtevant at the Star Tribune Newsroom has someone for us. Lori?
Yes, we'd like to shift gears again and talk about higher education funding. I have with me Irene Joyce from Brooklyn Park. Irene.
Thank you. Mr. Merle, Mr. Speaker, Ms. Wheelock, most of the emphasis this evening has been on K through 12 funding, and that seems to be where the newspapers and everybody else is talking about. I'm very interested in the status of higher education, and I know the state of Minnesota has one of the best reputations in the country for educated persons, and I'm wondering what you can do to maintain that for the state of Minnesota. And also, I'd like to say that I'm a parent of a college-age student, and I'm interested in finding out more about financial aid for students. I think this would be a great incentive for getting more students into school. But I'm also a part-time employee of MNSCU, and I know that the institutions also need funding. What is your opinion on this?
Who would like to tackle that? There is that argument over where does the money go? Does it go to the institution? Does it go to more students?
I think we should have her settle it. If she can be happy, if we can find a resolution that she can live with, then it's probably something we can all live with. But there are significant differences.
If I'm not mistaken, we're going to end up with about $100 million plus going to the University of Minnesota, and about that same amount increase going to the MinSCU system. There also will be some additional resources to through the university to academic health centers that will come through the tobacco endowments, if I'm not mistaken. There will be a portion of that in there. The argument right now, and I just want you to know that when the speaker and I leave this this program tonight, we're going back to the Capitol to help negotiate and mediate that higher ed deadlock that we seem to be engaged in. And it really is a discussion about whether or not the resources should go directly to the systems through the to the campuses or more to the students in financial aid. The Senate has taken a position that we should get more through financial aid, and we're going to negotiate that out. I don't know where the bottom line is, but that's really kind of the biggest difference between the House and the Senate.
What is the philosophy there? Why more for financial aid? Is there something wrong with the system right now?
No, I think the financial aid issue is an issue that comes up every 2 years, and we look at the formulas. We try to adjust it to changes in federal policy, but I think the Senate has tended to believe that if we try to get the aid to the student, and they'll make the right decisions on that. Versus going directly to the campuses. But you're going to have some of both. We know that, and it's just a matter of trying to figure out the balance.
Okay, you're arguing over an extra $100 million. Is it too simplistic to say, all right, 50 for the institutions and 50 for the student aid? I mean, somewhere in the middle?
Well, the $100 million was K-12, Ken, and I think the argument we've been talking about now is the
higher ed.
The higher ed,
but the extra money for higher education.
I think they're at about, of the overall increase, about $100 million for
MinSCU.
Yes, right.
Sure.
And the University of Minnesota. Then there is some small increase, I think, for the scholarships and grants.
I guess the question is, isn't this sort of an easy one to solve? One party wants it to go to the financial aid.
I'm finding out there's nothing easy to solve. That, even after you think you got it solved, there's a few speed bumps that come into play. The direct question tonight that Senator Moe and Commissioner Wheelock and I will engage in tends to be the student share. There's a 47% factor. There's a 45% factor in the Senate bill, 47% in the House bill. Again, the senator laid out the philosophy fairly well as to the philosophy being whether more money should go to the institutions themselves to provide program, or whether it's more money should go to the students themselves as they make the choices in which institutions to go to.
Shouldn't the House Republicans be the ones advocating for more money to the consumer so that those institutions compete a little bit more? Maybe that's an oversimplification of the ideologies at work here. But
No, it's not an oversimplification. This is a reversal.
No more politics as usual.
Let's hear from another citizen. Why don't we go up to Bemidji now? Got another question there?
Thanks a lot, Ken. I'm here with Alan Cole from Park Rapids, who has a question, part of an issue of great concern to people, especially in northwestern Minnesota, which is the state doing enough to help farm families? Alan?
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, what are you doing to help the agricultural community anyway? We're addressing education, we're addressing everything else, but agriculture always seems to take the back burner on these proposals. What are you doing?
Well, I'm from northwestern Minnesota, so maybe I'll start on that. First of all, Alan, the state of Minnesota can't do anything about the prices, and that's what farmers are facing. It's a price crisis. It's brought on by a number of factors. I think some of the trade agreements, the U.S. dollar is so strong against foreign currencies, that's having an impact on the exports. So Minnesota can't do anything about the price of the product, and that is the single biggest problem that farmers face today in Minnesota and throughout the country. But what are we doing? I think we've been working very diligently over the years to try to relieve some of the tax burden for farmers. Farmers do not pay a sales tax, for instance, on their equipment. They have the lowest effective rate in terms of the property tax classifications, and I might add that we want to have more property tax relief for farmers, which I think all of us are insistent on coming out of the compromised tax bill. So we and we put $70 million aside that will be going back to farmers to help them pay their May property tax payments that should be coming back to farmers before too long. So we are trying to do as much as we can from a state perspective, but this really, the price crisis is not something that the state government can do anything about.
Yeah. Alan, the being a farmer myself from southeastern Minnesota, the other side of the state than you, Alan, but I farm down there with my mom and my two brothers. It seems to me that the state government, now this is not the federal government, the state government legitimately can help farmers in three areas. The first is the costs, and Roger directly related to the major costs we place upon farm families in the state, that's property tax. We've worked on property tax. There will be a substantial property tax piece for farmers in the final bill that passes. The $70 million has been sent out already. The second area is adding value to a product, whether that's a product that may be livestock or whether it's ethanol promotion. And the third area is research, basically through our universities. You know, we appropriate and will be appropriating substantial monies to help with soybean mold research, with wheat scabs research. You know, those are three areas that I think the state, after this session, has acted very, very strongly in relationship to helping of the farm economy.
The agriculture commissioner has gotten into a bit of a flap over the CRP program, Conservation Resource Program, if I remember
Reserve.
That's how it is,
Reserve.
And it has to do with cutting off the number of farmers who can file for that program. You take land that you normally would till, put it into conservation, it's an environmental program, they get money for it. And the argument is that you do that, then the counties lose a tax base. So there's an argument, in a sense, between the state and the county governments over how many farmers ought to do this. What can the administration do not to bankrupt certain county governments, yet at the same time, this is a great program right now with crop prices so low to allow farmers to enroll in it?
You know, it's a good question. I know that there's been an issue with that in the last 24 hours, but unfortunately, I'm going to have to defer on that one. Focused a little bit on the budget issues and would perhaps defer to the speaker to see if he can address that issue as well.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't read the article. And I live with the commissioner.
It's an issue. It primarily was in the northwest corner of the state. And the commissioner apparently wrote a letter saying that they should not expand the eligibility to allow more farmers to put more acres aside in the CRP program. And he did so because his logic was that this would limit new farmers from getting into agriculture and concerns about Main Street business. Well, I don't know any young people that are getting into agriculture today based upon the price of the products. So that's a little bit faulty logic on his part. Most of the people in that area of the state want the expansion of additional acres in CRP. I don't believe it has any impact on the tax base. What they do is you simply reserve this land and they get a payment, and it allows farmers, in some cases these farmers have had very tough years. They're now working at Marvin Windows, they're working at Polaris and Thief River, and so they're working off the farm, but it gives, by allowing this payment, it allows them hopefully to at least hang on to the farm. So I question the commissioner's judgment on that, and I doubt whether or not we've heard the end of it.
All right, let's go to Mankato. We have a citizen there with a question.
Thank you, Ken. We opened the program talking about that urban-rural split and making policy, ensuring that policy makes sense to people in all regions of the state. And I'm standing here with Joyce Wilcox, who lives in North Mankato, and she has a question and concerns about the whole debate and discussion over mass transit, light rail in the metro area. Joyce?
Mr. Speaker and Senator Moe, my question is regarding light rail, and my concern is simply this. You alluded to the idea of winners and losers in all this debate. It seems to me that spending $60 million on light rail for the metro area could be a hard sell out here in rural Minnesota. It's not that we don't believe that it would improve the environment. It's not that at all. It's just that personally, it's hard for me to understand what it is that you're going to do to once you build the light rail to force citizens to use it. We all use the metro highways now, and we all can see that the fan lanes are grossly underused. Now, how is it that you can spend this money and then guarantee to us that somebody's actually going to use it? And if part of that program, as was alluded to earlier, is that we would get this $240 million from the federal government also, we need to remember that's also our money. And it's being spent on the metro area. I think it's going to be a hard sell in outstate Minnesota. I'd like to know how you respond to that.
I think it might be a hard sell for the Speaker, especially. Speaker Swigum, you're looking at a Republican caucus that you lead that isn't that enamored with this, and yet you need them to vote for $60 million in bonding money for a light rail system in South Minneapolis to Bloomington. Why are you doing this?
Martin, as you know, I've been an opponent of light rail in the past, and not very strongly supportive of it this year. In fact, I'm not only concerned about the $60 million, but I'm even more concerned, Joyce, about the ongoing operation subsidy that will be needed years and years and years in the future. And I think it's going to be substantial subsidies that will be needed there. Now, having said that, I try to look at ourselves as being state legislators and that we have statewide issues of concern. And in the agreement that we came upon, Joyce, I think Roger referred to this earlier, that not everybody is totally happy with everything in an agreement within a package. And suffice it to say that as we were negotiating, different groups of the three of us brought different issues forward that were important on the agenda. In this case, I think it would be fair to say that the governor was very, very supportive of light rail. Governor Ventura wanted it to be part of the package and was pretty strong about that, so being. I think that's fair to say. And while we wanted the tax cuts, and the Senate DFL and Senator Moe probably wanted the endowments, the governor was pretty strong about having light rail. And I think we've got a package that is well balanced. Do I support everything that's in it? No. And Martin, am I going to have a tough sell to some of my caucus members? For sure.
I hear you also need about 20 Democrats to support you because it's a bonding bill.
It's a bonding bill, yes.
What are the Democrats looking for out of this, or are they?
I think here's the sell. Yes, it's $60 million set aside. If the federal government doesn't fund it, then the money is going to go back into the general fund. Number two, there's at least $60 million, probably more, in road and bridge construction and bridge bonding, that most of which will probably go into greater Minnesota. And secondly, or third, I would make a point to somebody from Mankato or Rochester or St. Cloud, this is a part of what I believe will eventually be a fairly large multimodal transportation system that will connect regional hubs like Mankato, Rochester, St. Cloud with the rail systems into the light rail system skeleton within the metropolitan area and the bus transit system. So I think you have to look down the road. You can't just look at it just in based on what you see today. And then finally, I know it costs a lot to build a mile of road in Mankato, but it costs a heck of a lot more to build that here in the Twin Cities. And the controversy over expanding the freeways and building roads here is going to continue. I think we have to look to the future.
We only have less than 2 minutes to go. I would like to squeeze in one more question. Let's go to Minneapolis for that one.
We're going to be very quick. I'd like to introduce our one high school student participant, Brandon Peterson, a freshman from Blaine High School, with a class size question.
What do you guys have planned for the class sizes and all the schools from K to 12? Because I think they're a little too big. The schools are too crowded.
Okay, a big question and 1 minute to go. We'll start with the commissioner.
The governor agrees completely. He thinks that because of the dollars available, he focused most of it on the formula, but puts a big priority on reducing class size for kindergarten through third grade because that's where you're going to see the biggest performance boost.
There's going to be money aimed at reducing class size, Brandon. I don't think anybody will be so bold as to say 15 to 1, 17 to 1, 21 to 1 is the absolute right size, the most efficient, best education we can get, but we can say 26 to 1 is too many, and we know 32 to 1 is ridiculous, and we're going to have We're going to have a package that is going to help reduce those class sizes.
We only have a half a minute to go. Do you think the reaction to the governor's autobiography, which came out apparently a little bit earlier than the governor thought, is going to have any impact at all on last-minute negotiations? Senator?
I haven't heard all of the reaction, so I guess I'm not. I hope not. We're going to work our. This is a budget issue. We'll work out our differences, and we want to get this all done and go home by next Monday.
Mr. Speaker?
No.
All right, very good. Thank you all very much for joining us.